The power of prices is the process of dynamic discovery that underpins their emergence, not the fleeting consensus of a specific moment in time. The price is never right, but prices are as right as can be hoped for at that moment. Attempts to coerce prices without the ability to change the reality they communicate are, therefore, bound to run into trouble. And yet, we do not seem capable of accepting the truth of prices whenever it is inconvenient. To ensure that consensus can arrive at valid social truths, we require systems or institutions that withstand attempts at coercion and which tap into decentralized discovery. Martial arts are a fitting case study and an encouraging allegory for all that follows. A few decades ago, they were under the grip of bullshitting coercion. Today, they are thriving under a marketplace of ideas. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. This is the best in Bitcoin made audible, and I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we've got a great read today. This is actually another one from, I'm holding off on the guy's take just because I'm kind of getting my thoughts together, but this is one that I'm really glad I revisited before I started doing the audiobook for Bitcoin is Venice. But I had been sitting on the audio for a little while. I never actually quite finished it. But this is from Bitcoin Magazine. It was posted back in March, and it is from many time authors on this show, and honestly, some of my favorites. The style and just depth of everything that they have written has always impressed me. Alan Farrington and Sasha Myers. They are, if you go back through the list of all the things in this podcast, search for Farrington and Sasha Myers, because those are going to be the good ones. You're undoubtedly going to be entertained and informed, both at the same time. But this is a really fun article that I think was easy to dismiss. I think it was why I passed over it at first, despite being one of their articles, because the subject... I was very surprised by how apt the analogy was. And I was also surprised about what I did not know about the history of MMA and kind of what was happening in that world in the past, 30 years or so. And it's really a fascinating story. But I ran back into this, like I said, while I was doing the audiobook for Bitcoin is Venice, and it struck me. I was like, oh my God, I never actually published this one. So, Bitcoin is Venice is their book by the same authors, Alan and Sasha, and it's constructed kind of from a collection of their works on this topic, and this is the opening chapter, actually. So I highly recommend the book if you don't have it. I'm hoping the audio will be done soon, but if you want to get a head start on me, because Audible, I've still got a lot of work to do, and Audible takes a while to publish all of that stuff. And with a really great book, you always got to have a physical copy, just for the sake of saying I own it. But I really think you're going to love this piece, so stick around, and we will dive in just a moment. But really quick, I just want to thank Swan Bitcoin, the best Bitcoin onboarding service to set up an automatic savings plan, to buy Bitcoin whenever you want or need to automatically withdraw to your keys, to learn how to hold your keys, to learn about why Bitcoin matters, and go to their incredible conference coming up in November, the Pacific Bitcoin Conference in LA. Get 20% off your tickets with code GUYS. That is what I call all of you guys, and that is worth 20%. That is a precious word, so hang on to it. And then Fold and the Fold card. Drop your stupid credit card points and your airline miles. Psh! Get sats back on every single thing that you buy. I actually broke 12 million sats on the card. I've had it for just over a year. Do the math on that, man. Fold is fiat done the right way. And lastly, all of these sats that you're getting from Swan, your Swan Savings, and from Fold, they need a safe place to live. They need a secure, long-running, famous hardware wallet made by a dedicated Bitcoin-only team, and that is the Cold Card. Cold Card Mark IV, more specifically. Plus, they have a bajillion other amazing Bitcoin hardware and security products, so check them all out. Check them right in the show notes. Discount codes, links in the show notes. Go to it. Love it. Become one with it. The show notes. And with that, let's get into today's read. And it's titled, Bitcoin is Venice, Wrestling with the Truth, by Alan Farrington and Sasha Myers. Surprising as it may be, Bitcoin's history mirrors the history of mixed martial arts. This is an article in a series of adapted excerpts from Bitcoin is Venice by Alan Farrington and Sasha Myers, which is available for purchase on Bitcoin Magazine store right now. Link provided, and I will have it in the show notes for you guys. Let us begin with a thought experiment. Bitcoin's history mirrors the history of mixed martial arts, or MMA. Consider that prices emerge from action, and the truth of prices comes from experimentation. It is not dictated. It is discovered iteratively. Every transaction spreads knowledge, inching a price towards a better consensus, yet consensus itself is a moving target. MMA has gone through many iterations from its roots in arts like judo to the form we know today, and it continues to undergo this process through the natural experiment every individual fight represents. The power of prices is the process of dynamic discovery that underpins their emergence, not the fleeting consensus of a specific moment in time. The price is never right, but prices are as right as can be hoped for at that moment. Attempts to coerce prices without the ability to change the reality they communicate are therefore bound to run into trouble. And yet we do not seem capable to accept the truth of prices whenever it is inconvenient. To ensure that consensus can arrive at valid social truths, we require systems or institutions that withstand attempts at coercion and which tap into decentralized discovery. Martial arts are a fitting case study and an encouraging allegory for all that follows. A few decades ago, they were under the grip of bullshitting coercion. Today, they are thriving under a marketplace of ideas. In the beginning was the fight. It's kind of crazy when you think about the history of martial arts. Since the dawn of time, people have been trying to figure out better ways to fuck people up. Since they figured out language and figured out how to teach skills, they've been working on techniques. And not until 1993 did we really know what worked. Joe Rogan. The Joe Rogan Experience MMA Show 98 with Luke Thomas. Wrestling is probably the oldest sport in the world. The earliest evidence for it dates from cave paintings in France over 15,000 years ago. We also discovered that most holds practiced today were known in ancient times. Boxing is a little younger, depicted as far back as the 3rd millennium BC in Sumerian relief. The reader might therefore be forgiven for believing there is little more to learn about the art of fighting. And yet, the modern world has only learned which fighting techniques are truly effective in the last 30 years. Few sports have evolved as much in recent decades, fewer still tracing their lineage to prehistory. As Joe Rogan alludes to above, 1993 marks the birth of the Ultimate Fighting Championship. UFC spawned a free marketplace of fighting ideas called Mixed Martial Arts, or MMA. Before, charm and authority shielded much of martial arts from scrutiny. Competition was limited, and the truth of stylistic superiority could not be definitively established. The UFC, along with its famed fighting arena, the Octagon, created an environment where competing hypotheses could be systematically tested. With nowhere for falsehoods to hide, truth might finally stand a fighting chance. The recent evolution of martial arts serves as a unique case study to understand the ways in which ideas are created, tested, and spread. Instead of arguing about the hypothetical judo versus karate fight with your mates after one too many pints, the UFC would run the experiment for all to observe. Instead of judging a given martial art by how cool it looked in a movie, it would have to prove its efficacy against a skilled, motivated, and resisting opponent. Deference to a sensei would no longer suffice. Mere decree would hold no value. Traditions would be questioned and schools humiliated. Others would emerge from unsuspected corners of the world. In that sense, we can say after 1993, fighting stopped being theoretical. It became practical. We will evaluate the evolution of fighting using three settings: the movie set, the dojo, and the octagon. We will loosely link each with the three ancient Greek modes of persuasion: pathos, or emotion; ethos, or authority; and logos, or reason. And three different ways of learning: inspiration, rote, and praxis. We will see how ineffective ideas were spread and what would eventually combat them. Ideally, a front kick to the face. This is the story of how the UFC unleashed the competitive forces of free markets onto martial arts. It is, by extension, an allegory for the power of competition in incentivizing the search for and discovery of truth. The movie set, or the appeal to emotions and aesthetic knowledge.
It is impossible for somebody to lie unless he thinks he knows the truth. Producing bullshit requires no such conviction.
Harry Frankfurt, on Bullshit. Starting in the 1960s, Hollywood was largely responsible for the spread of Eastern martial arts to a Western audience. Many of today's greatest martial artists were drawn in by movies such as Bruce Lee's Enter the Dragon or Jean-Claude Van Damme's Bloodsport. The romantic image of a skilled fighter swiftly disposing of a dozen goons on his way to glory is more than enough to make most kids search for their nearest kung fu club. Unfortunately for many, their unrealistic expectations were rewarded only with bullshit. Hollywood looks to sell movie tickets, not rigorously test fighting techniques in realistic combat scenarios. Movies spread ideas and techniques of martial arts to resonate visually and emotionally with their audience and generate box office revenues. Ancient Greeks dubbed this method for convincing people pathos, an appeal to emotion. You believe me because you like me. What you learn, you know, or you think you know, because of how it makes you feel. It feels right. It is the distinctly aesthetic way to acquire knowledge. It is pleasing. It is calming. Its forms are smooth, symmetrical, and flush. Knowledge arrived at by this form of inspiration can, of course, be legitimate, but we can only know this by providing a proof. If practical, as opposed to deductive, a proof requires a test. But perhaps these fighting methods are never supposed to be tested, only admired. In fact, the point in these circumstances is precisely to avoid such a test at all costs. It is the feeling of knowledge that must be preserved, not the fact of it, or likely lack thereof. No matter how good these movies are, and some are bloody good, they put form over function. A punch no longer travels the shortest distance to its target. It takes a dramatic looping detour. Street fights rarely end up on the ground. They are perfectly choreographed across streetscapes. The street ceases to be an interactive terrain of combat and becomes instead the inert setting of a melodramatic dance. If not the dance, then certainly the drama is compelling enough for the audience to suspend its disbelief, which is when the virus strikes. We buy some of the extravaganza because of how pretty it looks, and we emotionally bond with the hero. Yet, long after the credits have rolled and the lights turned back on, moviegoers will still associate karate with near superhuman feats. Most know it's all exaggerated, but we probably will still believe a black belt is someone to fear. In moderation, a serious martial arts school might resort to breaking boards to attract new members, a useless practice never taught in a self-respecting regime. Taken to the extreme,
We get fake martial arts that teach you to channel life energy or chi into your strikes. This is total fantasy. The emitters and receivers of these ideas alike are ambivalent to their real effectiveness. Their assessment is based solely on how it looks and makes them feel. This is as divorced from empirical testing as it gets. The dynamics are like those of cult members accepting indoctrination purely for the sense of belonging it can bring. The dojo, or the appeal to authority and codified knowledge. Education is an admirable thing, but it is well to remember from time to time that nothing that is worth knowing can be taught. Oscar Wilde. You must bow before entering the dojo. It's tradition. It's respect. It's Japanese. It is a show of deference to authority, signaling a willingness to learn from the master. Unlike in fake martial arts, students of real martial arts believe in their teacher and her craft because of her accomplishments and standing in the wider community. This is akin to the trust we put in police officers and government officials. We might not be able to directly assess the veracity and deservedness of their claim, but it stands to reason that many others have done so. Ideas are tested for effectiveness through an intermediary. The dojo spreads ideas by appealing to authority, or ethos. The knowledge we derive, we learn by rote. As a child might memorize her times tables by performing a kind of mental operation, so too she learns her karate steps by repetition of a physical operation. The knowledge has been codified and transmitted. One of the greatest such teachers, or sensei, is Kano Jigoro. Born in 1860, 8 years before the Meiji Restoration, when Japan began to industrialize. This period also marks the abolition of the samurai warrior class. Its three main disciplines were sword fighting, or kinjutsu, archery, or kyojutsu, and unarmed combat, or jujitsu. As the samurai class began to fade, so did its knowledge. Enter Jigoro. While not a samurai, Jigoro trained in martial arts and became well known for his meticulous recording of the jujitsu techniques he deemed most effective. He described his work as keeping what I felt should be kept and discarding what I felt should be discarded. Old masters sought Jigoro to share their techniques in the hope they would not die out. These masters accumulated hard-won stores of capital in the form of knowledge gained through experimentation. Unable to maintain, let alone nurture, replenish, and grow these stocks themselves, the masters looked for someone they hoped would. They feared their knowledge would depreciate entirely, leaving nothing behind. Jigoro offered the means to avert such an epistemological disaster. He called his new school Judo, the gentle way. Given the task at hand and the high quality of the result, Jigoro seems to have achieved wonders. Judo remains one of the more effective martial arts and is a great foundation for aspiring fighters. But its flaws were inherent in Jigoro's methods. By choosing what to keep or discard, he acted as the authority. We might say his doctrine acted as a server, and all who followed were merely clients. Of course, as a single server with no exposure to feedback, the doctrine itself invited self-induced vulnerability. The rigid structure Jigoro created shielded Judo from outside criticism and internal experimentation alike. Students defer to their sensei, and dojo rules prohibit using techniques from another tradition. What if I punched you before you got close enough to grab my collar and throw me to the floor? It's not allowed. You may only compete against other practitioners of your art. As a result, the art slowly loses any grasp of the reality of consequential combat, and turns into a game played against itself. Don't strike, don't grab the trousers, don't use leg locks, don't flick the genitals. Don't check if it works. The rigid techniques and rules of a given school tend to lead it to evolve like a species trapped on an island. It becomes hyper-specialized for its environment. But what if the environment changes? The chink in a dojo's proverbial armor can appear during an exhibition match pitting two styles against one another. In 1963, boxer Milo Savage fought judoka Jean LaBelle in a contest meant to show the superiority of American boxing. Things didn't go as the organizers hoped. LaBelle threw Savage to the ground and choked him unconscious. It was the first sanctioned mixed martial arts fight in the United States. When two very different hypotheses meet, we may get surprising results. There is, in fact, no way to know for sure without a fight. It must be tried empirically. We might say it cannot be modeled. Even if we could perfectly mathematize the fighter's abilities and parameterize the dynamics of the fight, the result would still be computationally irreducible. Why simulate the entire universe when the universe will happily simulate itself? Why not just watch the fight? Another seminal exhibition fight occurred in 1988 when kickboxer Rick Rufus fought Thai boxer Chongpuik Kitsongrit. The Thai fighter won with a single technique. He kicked Rufus's legs until they stopped working. The technique is common in Thai boxing but was rarely used in American kickboxing. After the fight, Rick's brother, Duke Rufus, said in an interview, "I hope that people realize that Thais, if they fight our rules, they're not going to win, and we're not going to fight their rules. We experimented tonight, but we found out it's not worth it. It doesn't take too much talent to kick to the legs." Duke eventually became one of America's best Thai boxing coaches. He realized that kickboxing had not yet developed an answer to this simple but effective technique. It was fundamentally unpredictable. But now that an experiment had been run, the truth was out. The challenge now was to systematize such learnings. The global martial arts community, nascent as it even was, had to find a way of testing techniques repeatedly by running empirical tests rather than aesthetic comparisons or thought experiments. Only then could we hope to discover the truth. The Octagon, or the appeal to reason and practical knowledge. Let's pause for a second right here and talk about how Swan Bitcoin is having the most bodacious bash for Bitcoiners this November at the Pacific Bitcoin Conference. Michael freaking Saylor, Jan Pritzker, Lynn Alden, Pierre Richard, Guy Swan, oh hello, Preston Pish, Alex Gladstein, Natalie Brunel, BTC Sessions. Wait, is that the author of this very article, Alan Farrington? Yes, that is right. They will all be there, plus many more, all amazing speakers and guests. This is going to be legit. You do not want to miss it. I've already heard there's going to be some exciting announcements. And, you know, honestly, the bear market is where the really amazing stuff happens, in my opinion. We're going to have an absolute blast. I'm getting really excited about it. And with code GUYS, you guys can get 20% off with code GUYS. It is special just for you guys and any other guys who want to use it, and you can spread it to all of those other guys, all the guys that you know who want to go, and just tell those guys that GUYS gets them 20% off. You see what I did there? And then while you're over there, you want to set up your Swan Bitcoin savings plan. Automatic purchase, automatic withdrawal. There's nothing simpler. Check them out. Guess where you're going to find them? The show notes. All right. With that, let's jump back in. The Octagon, or the appeal to reason and practical knowledge. A true partnership between the people on the ground managing holistically and the researchers supporting their efforts needs to start with mutual respect. But since the time of Descartes and the beginning of modern science, society has so elevated the status of the academic researcher and so lowered that of the land manager that generally the researcher speaks with more authority on management today than the person actually managing the farm from day to day and producing food. And this is so even though farmers and pastoralists were the ones who discovered which plants and animals could be domesticated and then bred thousands of varieties from them several millennia before scientists existed. Alan Savory, Holistic Management. The Gracie Challenge was an open invitation to martial arts schools in the Los Angeles Valley. Come fight a member of the Gracie family. Kung Fu, Judo, and Karate practitioners all rose to the challenge, hoping to demonstrate the superiority of their art. The grainy footage, most of which dates from the early 1990s, shows a consistent story. The Gracies took their opponents down to the ground and submitted them with a choke or joint lock. pretty kicks and punches were no match for someone versed in ground fighting. The Gracie's art is now known worldwide as Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is a cornerstone of modern mixed martial arts training, but in the early 1990s, it was virtually unknown. Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu's story starts with a roaming Japanese immigrant named Mitsuyo Maeda. Born in 1878, Maeda studied judo under its founder, Jigoro. He traveled the world, reportedly winning over 2,000 professional bouts, many against practitioners of other arts. He eventually settled in Brazil, where he taught a version of judo with a high emphasis on ground fighting. He called it jiu-jitsu. One of Maeda's students was named Carlos Gracie. The art spread through the family and was for a time known as Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. Although Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu's techniques are like judo's, its culture and training methodology are not. Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu encourages playful experimentation. New techniques are constantly developed and tested by the community. In comparison, judo has an official list of techniques that can only be edited by an official body. Whereas judo operates on a client-server model, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is a truly peer-to-peer martial art. Whereas judo focuses on competition within its community, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu was from the start focused on testing itself against other arts. Whereas judo seems intent on honing an aesthetic equilibrium, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is a dynamic process, never settling, always looking to discover its own flaws and improve. The veracity encoded in judo must be trusted. The veracity encoded in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu can be verified. The measure of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu's success has always been effectiveness. It does not bow to authority nor look to convince with aesthetics. It appeals to reason, or logos, and it grants knowledge in the form of what James C. Scott calls Métis in his magisterial Seeing Like a State, which we reference repeatedly. Of this form of knowledge, Scott writes, Métis is most applicable to broadly similar but never precisely identical situations requiring a quick and practiced adaptation that becomes almost second nature to the practitioner. The skills of Métis may well involve rules of thumb, but such rules are largely acquired through practice, often in formal apprenticeship, and a developed feel or knack for strategy. Métis resist simplification into deductive principles which can be successfully transmitted through book learning, because the environments in which it is exercised are too complex and non-repeatable that formal procedures of rational decision-making are impossible to apply. In a sense, Métis lies in that large space between the realm of genius, to which no formula can apply, and the realm of codified knowledge, which can be learned by rote. Métis, hard-won, discovered, evolving practical knowledge, is needed to act, and where the necessity for human action exists, the knowledge it allows the actor to generate comes about in a helpfully, practically reflexive manner. Scott writes, we might reasonably think of situated local knowledge as being partisan knowledge, as opposed to generic knowledge. That is, the holder of such knowledge typically has a passionate interest in a particular outcome. An insurer of commercial shipping for a large, highly capitalized maritime firm can afford to rely on probability distributions for accidents. But for a sailor or captain hoping for a safe voyage, it is the outcome of the single event, a single trip, that matters. Métis is the ability and experience necessary to influence the outcome, to improve the odds in a particular instance. The mixed martial artist does not want to win a moral or an aesthetic victory, nor does he want to win the hypothetical or the median fight. He wants to win this fight. He has a passionate interest in the particular outcome of his own victory and the avoidance of the physical pain that would come with his own loss. He is deeply motivated to learn in the moment, to treat every action and reaction as an experiment that can improve his performance. He does not want merely to observe the outcome. He wants to influence it. Back in Los Angeles, Florian Gracie was looking to reach a wider audience. The family's wins against local martial arts schools spread its reputation across the valley, but not far beyond. In 1993, Florian created the Ultimate Fighting Championship. It would have, quote, no time limit, no rules, just like the challenges. Fighters from all styles would be invited. The Gracie family enlisted Royce Gracie, not because he was their best, but because his slim frame would make his victory even more of a statement. Royce went on to win the first UFC, defeating bigger and stronger opponents with techniques most had never seen before. Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu's effectiveness could no longer be denied. In the 28 years since, much was established, almost none of which could have been predicted, and certainly not modeled from mathematical models of fighting. Entire arts like Aikido were shown to be ineffective, and flashy, striking arts like Kung Fu or Karate were outcompeted by more prosaic wrestling or boxing. Arts mostly unknown a few decades ago, like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu or Russian Sambo, both descending from Judo, are now considered among the most effective. Today still, new techniques are emerging, like the calf kick, which looks to cripple the opponent's leg by hitting a nerve behind the knee. Each time two fighters step in the octagon, an experiment ensues. Techniques from all arts are empirically tested for effectiveness. Success means victory. It is not a popularity contest, nor do authority figures decree what does and doesn't work. The mat doesn't lie, as the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu saying goes. Try it and see. It's the only test that matters, and only the truth will emerge. Going for the finish, or the tap out. Stop trying to hit me and hit me. Lawrence Fishburne as Morpheus, The Matrix. The rules of the UFC have drastically increased the cost and reduced the returns of peddling fake martial arts. Bullshit artists can now be called out, and the arts they espouse have been unequivocally shown to be ineffective. It is not enough for an art to hide behind a veneer of respectability. Authority first needs to prove itself in combat, lest it be ignored or even ridiculed. By introducing a space where fighting ideas could be empirically tested against a creative, motivated, and resisting opponent, the UFC heralded a golden age of discovery. The result, called mixed martial arts, is ever-evolving, never static. It is not a destination, but a process. It is not a list of techniques, but a mindset to test ideas and adopt any that proves effective in combat. It took Jigoro's insight of, quote, keeping what I felt should be kept and discarding what I felt should be discarded, and scaled it beyond one man to a community of purposeful actors. The UFC established new incentives to discover, preserve, and protect truth in a combative but respectful way. Even though its fights are violent affairs, it convinces through nonviolent means. It appeals to reason. Unfortunately, until recently in human history, non-coercive means of convincing others were necessarily social, and as such, they suffered from Karl Popper's paradox of tolerance, where the tolerance of intolerance leads to the rule of the latter. In a society of pacifists, the lone dissenter becomes the king. Violence has only ever been prevented by one of three means: inherent human goodness, perceived benefit from cooperation, or credible or enacted threats of violence greater and more terrifying still. An appreciation for elements of all three is precisely the rationale for learning martial arts and self-defense in general. That the good and the brave might defend not only themselves, but can cooperate with those who cannot defend themselves. by threatening the malicious with greater inflicted costs than they expect in illegitimate gains. This may all sound intellectually impressive at first glance, but it's really nothing more than pointing out that civilization is superior to a state of nature. That the encouragement of capital and deterrent of morality, in other words, civilization, have historically been the best and last defenses against violence, has given the immoral a clear incentive. Stigmatize and ridicule morality. Demonize the honest formation of capital, or infiltrate the institutions intended to support either, voluntarily established or otherwise, and their prospective violence might generate higher returns. But now, this equation features a novel variable, and one tinged with historical irony at that. After millennia of compounding technological advances taking us from the sword and shield to the longbow, to the trebuchet, to the handgun, to the tank, to the dreadnought, to the fighter jet, to the atomic bomb, humanity has discovered a technology that only resists and disincentivizes violence and has no other use. In short, Bitcoin fixes this. In long, the remainder of Bitcoin is Venice. All right, guys. That was Wrestling with the Truth by Alan Farrington and Sasha Myers. It is a guest post. It is opinions are entirely their own. Disclaimer, blah, blah, blah. Unfortunately, I don't have a lot of time to do a guy's take, so we're going to skip on that. And I'm probably going to reference this one anyway in my guy's take for tomorrow. But there is a lot to unpack in Bitcoin is Venice. Like, that whole book, like I said, all of what Alan and Sasha do, I'm a huge fan of their writing. And super honored to be doing the audiobook, to be honest. And it's fun to just read back, even though I've read the majority of the book already. It's just good to read back through it. I'm constantly finding little nuggets. And, you know, this actually, right at the very end of this, I love just the framing. And this is such an interesting way to frame it. Is going back to the last paragraph, it says, but now this equation features a novel variable, and one tinged with historical irony at that. After millennia of compounding technological advances taking us from the sword and shield to the longbow, to the trebuchet, to the handgun, to the tank, to the dreadnought, to the fighter jet, to the atomic bomb, humanity has discovered a technology that only resists and disincentivizes violence and has no other use. And that is such an interesting way to frame the concept of what money is and what money does. Literally, the purpose of money is to establish the ability to cooperate as a collective in spite of not being able to trust, to disincentivize violence because working together produces more than working separately. Certainly working in opposition to each other. And the best monies of history have always been that which are most independent. As I said, I don't know how many times recently, the neutral money, the radically neutral money, has historically been the most prevalent because it is specifically a trust problem that is being solved. But that essentially what it is doing is resisting and disincentivizing violence. And that is explicitly what Bitcoin is incredibly good at. That's what its entire system is around accomplishing, is disincentivizing cheating, disincentivizing the manipulation of the system rather than its cooperation. Essentially, the path of least resistance is complete honesty and verification in the Bitcoin system. The path of greatest resistance is to fight or attempt to cheat or manipulate or undo the history of the system. And it is specifically proof of work that makes it that way. But I just really like this piece. And there was just a surprising history I did not know. It's one of those things that, like, when I first read this, it's one of those things where you as you're reading through it, you recognize some of the pieces of it, like the pieces of the story, but you didn't know it really happened. Like, I'm not like a huge MMA watcher. Like, I don't watch UFC much. It's kind of like sports ball for me, is that if we're out with friends and that's what people are watching, I can get into it and I can enjoy it, but it's no different than like a passing show or something. But I gotta admit, I have a lot more respect for it since I read this, and I've slowly listened to a couple of the episodes that Joe Rogan covers because I know he's like super into it. It's really fascinating as a platform for challenging ideas, for, I mean, you know, just what they lay out in this article, for like kind of boots on the ground reality. It's like, what is the truth of it? Don't give me an authority. Don't tell me what you know is the truth. Don't tell me what is aesthetically the best or is, you know, the thing that you have to do. Like, don't give me any of that crap. Show me. Prove it to me. And there's something just really fascinating in that. And I think this is also part of this, maybe part of kind of the globalization, but really it's the opening up of everything. Like, we've torn down so many barriers. You know, it's so easy to get lost in the here and now and the little things and the chaos that is happening in the world. But really what is happening, I feel like, is a massive healing process. But it's just incredibly messy because we were very unhealthy. We were very addicted to bad things. And the withdrawal from those bad things is going to be incredibly painful. But think of all of the barriers that have been broken down. Like, the MMA thing and UFC is such a tiny example of what I think is happening on a much, much bigger scale. And what's funny, too, is that, you know, decentralization or an open liberty is more stressful. You know, an intersection where you go to and like everybody's just kind of free for all is far more stressful than one that has a stoplight. But the former may actually be safer because you're actually participating. You're responding to the environment. You're watching the other people. Whereas in the situation with the lights, you're being told exactly what to do and you're watching the lights. The chaos of liberty produces far more valid and information-dense, knowledge-dense results in the economy. But it does often feel more stressful because you're actually having to participate. You're actually having to put your input in. You're not being led. You're not having your hand held and moved through all of these things. And that's kind of what we're in this new environment where all of our ideas are clashing. We're having this global identity crisis where we don't know who we are, and all of our narratives and trusted institutions are falling apart around us, and we're having to rediscover ourselves. And it's so kind of amazing and almost serendipitous that we have Bitcoin among all of this. You know, it's just a crazy, crazy time to be alive. But I want to thank Swan Bitcoin, CoinKite, and The Fold Card for supporting the show and, you know, keeping me fed and coffeed up. And this is Bitcoin Audible. I will be back tomorrow with another episode. And until then, everybody, take it easy, guys. The world makes way for the man who knows where he is going. Ralph Waldo Emerson.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.